Thank you very much for asking me along. I'm delighted to be here. And I don't often speak to such an erudite audience. When I was asked to come along to a theological society, I thought, oh no, I'm going to be found out for what the fact that I don't really know much. So yeah, I hope perhaps learn more than I'm able to impart. But I'm willing to do that, and hopefully even if you're able to help me refine some of the ideas, because a lot of the last 9 years I've been doing this job has been a reflection and trying to understand what's actually going on in politics. And I think the word transformation is quite appropriate, because there has been a transformation in understanding of many different issues in society. And I think in trying to diagnose that transformation and the roots of it, the foundations of why it has happened, we may be able to try and turn things around. And hopefully my technology will hold out as well. And the falling microphone wasn't an omen of things to come. But we are living at a time of considerable confusion. And most often I get asked to speak to parish groups or to go into schools. And especially with the school children, there are so many issues confronting them and so many different ideas competing in their heads, and for them to try and get a grip of what is a basis for making decisions in my life. And all the different messages that are portrayed in the magazines that they read and the television. It is an incredibly complex world for them. I can make this PowerPoint available to anyone to save you taking notes if you want. If I say some particularly accidental word of wisdom, maybe write that down instead. But if it's anything that's on the slides, I'll make sure I pass those to David, and he can get them to you. So there's a whole host of issues. If we just think of the typical media coverage that young people in particular are bombarded with, you'll find there's a whole host of... What's this? Oh, this does work. You know, there's a whole contrast. This one's a wee bit out of date, but we see issues like racism coming along, the role of religious leaders. You know, Rowan Williams, we saw, had a particular furore a few weeks ago when he talked about Islam and the role of Islam in society and how should we, a secular society, deal with that. Cardinal O'Brien has been talking a lot recently, especially on the role of conscience among politicians. You know, that's an area I want to return to later, you know, if we want to bring a bit of change. We've been involved a lot in things like homosexual adoption. Should couples, same-sex couples, be allowed to adopt children? We've seen the whole movement for the influence of that movement for the last 9 years has been quite incredible from my perspective, how I've watched the transformation within politics, within social policy. It's quite incredible. We've got the whole debt business. Over lunch I was hearing at my table, we're talking about the credit crunch. What's going on in our society in financial issues? What about schooling? I don't know if it was a very interesting debate during the week. Reverend David Robertson was on Radio Scotland talking about faith schools, the role of faith in schools, and he made a very good point that even those who don't believe in faith schools actually want to impart a faith themselves, and it just happens to be a secular faith. This is the issue. This is alluding to stem cell research, which you'll be aware that the Human Fertilisation Embryology Bill is going on just now. Right to life issues, antisocial behaviour issues. You know, there's a judge just this week coming out criticising the breakdown of family life and the breakdown of society. So we've got massive number of areas where young people, not just young people, we are all affected by it. We can all easily absorb the issues or the values of the world, the values that are portrayed to us in the media. And very often it's done with what I'd say is ambiguous language. There are so many words that sound positive. You know, there seems to be a positive language that's behind this new vision of society. You know, so we are asked to be open and to be respectful. And very often that's code words for, listen, we don't want to hear a critique of our position. Just accept and respect it. Don't say it's wrong, don't criticise it. You know, we have health documents. This intrigued me at first when I saw a health document. where you would expect a somber analysis of health issues. When I read it, it seemed evangelical to me, in that people were saying we must celebrate diversity. Celebrate, it's not the sort of language you would expect in a health document, but that's the sort of thing. That document in particular was the sexual health strategy, and it went on to explain what it exactly means by diversity, that all things are equally to be celebrated in society. Now, those things can't be said without them having an impact. Things like equality, things like freedom, human rights, gender, family, these are words that may have positive overtones for us, but when you look at how they are used, they have been used very effectively to give a different understanding of society as we understand it. I'll use gender, for example. I mean, people think gender is male and female. But if you follow closely things that are happening at the United Nations and even at the European Convention of Human Rights, the way it's being interpreted in Strasbourg, gender has a very different meaning. There's a couple of famous cases. Goodwin versus UK, and I think it was 2001, the judges in the European Court said that we can no longer determine gender on biological criteria, which sounds a nice thing to say in a judgment if it rolls off your tongue, but what does that mean? It really means that gender now is not male and female, it's not man or woman, it's a whole different notion. But that was building on it. It's happening all over the world. There was another famous case, Casey versus Planned Parenthood in the 90s, and they were talking about freedom, and they were saying that one of the aspects of being human is the ability to choose what you are yourself, you know, a complete idea of freedom that knows no bounds, not even biological criteria. So the human being is not a gift from God, or it hasn't been created, but it's something that we ourselves can transform at our will. Now, through this presentation to us, you'll see a few of these things which are unreadable. It's just wee notes for myself, actually, so that I can remember points I wanted to make. But this was one that, for example, diversity training is now in all of our major areas of local government and local services, like in schooling and the police force and the fire brigade and health services. And they look at, here's one example, it was a question that was put down in Parliament by Sandra White to ask the Scottish Executive, as it was then, whether police forces would have their own diversity unit, looking at promoting equality in areas of sexual orientation, race, age, religion and faith, disability and gender issues. So there are groups that are out there focusing on diversity and promoting a particular version. Now, I'm in favour of diversity as freedom. I respect people's freedom to do things within a particular bound of what's right and wrong. But when you look at what that diversity training consists of, there is a transformation of the most fundamental elements of our society going on. And my job really has been seeing that firsthand. You know, the work I do really is trying to monitor, well, what are the Scottish Executive up to? What sort of consultation papers are they putting through, the bills? What is the policy? What's driving the social policy? And that job is representing the bishops, usually trying to give the Catholic view on these issues, and I try to impart that to the politicians. And also to our own communities, trying to let them know what things are happening in society. How can we, as a Christian community, respond to them? Should we respond to them? What sort of messages should we be passing to them? I've put the bottom one down really to give you an idea of the perspective. You might think, well, I often get asked things like, John, there's a lot of people who are poor in Scotland, or people who come from, you know, deprived backgrounds or living terrible housing conditions and things like that. Why has the church had so much focus on issues round about the family and round about sexuality? Why that emphasis? And it's a fair enough question. You know, we as a church are as concerned about people living in bad conditions and people suffering poverty and deprivation and poor education and so on. We are concerned about those. But the difference, I think, in family issues and about human sexuality is that we have competing and opposite views of what's going on there. Whereas in issues to do with social justice, I don't think there's anyone, I've not encountered anyone who's in favour of poverty, who's in favour of bad housing, who's in favour of injustice and poor education. So it tends to be that we do put out, the bishops put out statements on those issues actually, but they don't get any media coverage. So the media are interested in where are we giving a message which is different from the ways of the world, from the culture that's pervading Scottish society. So it tends to be that. But I wanted to emphasise there's a very famous encyclical letter from John Paul II, one of the major social teaching documents for Catholics, made this point: a family policy must be the basis and driving force of all social policies. Because we believe, I think the Christian anthropology supports it, that the foundation of a society is the family. It's the family that's the basic cell. And if we can get that right, if we can get that foundation right, we can grow a good society out of that. We will have a healthy civil society if that civil society is made up of families coming together to achieve things that they can't do on their own. And if the civil society sees its role as supporting the foundation, supporting family life, and then out of a healthy civil society, we can have a healthy political society. So that is the foundation. If we can get that foundation right, it will help us sort out society in its civic and its political manifestations. I'm trying to avoid doing it. I don't know if this is a right thing or a wrong thing, but I tend to have quotes off the top of my head, but it's always Catholic sources, and I'm maybe thinking maybe that might put you off if I use them. But anyway, there's a Archbishop Fulton Sheen, who's a famous American sort of evangelical bishop, who says that if we make a mess of the family, 30 years later, we will see the same mess in politics. You know, that if we mess up there, we will mess up as that family grows up and works its way through society. And this week you may have seen that a judge was crying out, really, saying that what have we done to family life in the UK? It's falling apart. And what's happening in our communities as these families fall apart? Some of the issues I've directly worked in, I just thought I'd list them to put a label to them, to show that these aren't just ideas or philosophies of people sort of debating at a debating society, or maybe for parliamentarians it can seem that in the abstract. Sort of these are philosophical ideas to be explored, but they become real when they're manifested in policies or new laws. And we've seen a whole host of them, which are I've listed here. I'll say a couple of words on some of them. But the Gender Recognition Act, that came out of that Goodwin European Court decision. The Gender Recognition Act, if you're not aware of it, allows me or anyone to go to a panel just now and say to them, listen, I may look like a man, but actually I feel that I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. Now, you don't need to have surgery. You just have to convince them that you want to live as a woman in a man's body. And the Gender Recognition Act will allow you to have your new gender recognised. And with that, you will get a new birth certificate. You will have to be treated by all social institutions as being female. So if I get the certificate from the panel, I am now female. And there are penalties for organisations, including employers, including churches, who refuse to accept that person is now the new assigned, or as they would call it, a recognised gender. So it's a real manifestation of that, what sounds like a philosophical idea, that we can't judge gender on biological criteria. Now, the liberal, if I can use it in its broadest terms, the libertarian view is that people like me are biological determinists. We're restricting people's freedom by saying you're constrained by your biology. These people say that, back to this Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision, it was an American one, of course, but that idea was, no, being human means I can decide what I am for myself, including deciding, yes, I'm a woman, despite the biological appearances to the contrary. So it's quite a... was it the Civil Partnership Act? Again, we saw a change there. Civil Partnership Act doesn't call it marriage, but more or less it grants just about exact rights to same-sex couples to be seen in society as married, be treated the same as spouses. Sexual health services, well, we've seen a proliferation of sexual health services just even targeted at children. Children now can go and get sexual health services without having to inform their parents. And we've heard of cases of children as young as 11 and 12. And that would include getting an abortion without your parents' consent or even knowledge. Children's rights has been an issue. That is a massive issue in its own perspective. I suspect a lot of the people involved in that, you know, do mean well, but there can be an exaggeration of children's rights, which if you exaggerate children's rights, the child isn't actually capable of exercising those rights. So what you're really calling for is someone to come in to the family and exercise those rights on behalf of the child. Now, I recognise we do need to look after children, especially as a family life breaks down and society breaks down. But an exaggeration of those rights is calling for someone to come in inside the family. It's not recognising the proper role of the family and its autonomy. Family law, well, we've seen changes in family law as well. That's continued. Similar to the civil partnership, a differentiation in society, a different view of what is the basic building block of the family. So cohabitation, for example, was legally recognised under the Family Law Bill. Divorce was made easier. Adoption laws, well, I've referred to that already, but the now Catholic adoption agencies look as if we're going to be forced to treat homosexual applicants on the same basis as a married couple. In fact, under the sexual orientation regulations, it would be illegal if I had two transsexuals come in and apply for a child. If I had a married couple and I differentiated between the two sets of couples on the basis of their sexual orientation, I would be breaking the law. But that's how far the influence of the homosexuality. Then we've got all these bioethical issues, stem cell research, cloning, abortion. We've got other social issues, terrorism. What does that mean about human rights, about freedom? You know, should we be imprisoning people for 28 days, 42 days, 90 days? All these sorts of things. Issues on Trident, euthanasia, diversity training, I've mentioned that. It's a whole area, a whole sweep of issues that are very difficult to boil them down and get to the root of, well, what's right and what's wrong? What's driving all this? And really that's what the last 9 years of my sort of professional life have been, trying to come to grips with that. What is driving it? Now, there is one way of looking at it. There's several philosophers, and this may be you, Ray, that you'll be able to help me, but there are different ways of looking at it, but it certainly seems that a lot of them draw back to philosophical ideas that hit us at the time of the Enlightenment. And I've drawn from Robert Bork, who was nominated as a Supreme Court judge in the States, and he was blocked because of his anti-abortion views. But he did a critique of society, and he sort of tried to pull together all the philosophical trends that were happening in society and tried to get to the root of them and think, well, where have people gone wrong? What is driving this? What is behind the views that get us to where we are in society today? And he identified, if we can think of it, as just think of the French Revolution, liberty, equality and fraternity. We look at those views, which are good views in themselves. But his point he makes is that liberty and equality have become preeminent among those. There's interesting work by a group called Focolare. I don't know if you're aware of them. But Focolare, it's an ecumenical group that was founded by a Catholic. And they've spent a lot of time campaigning on fraternity. They say that we've forgotten that we, you know, of the brotherhood of man, and the fact that we have a solidarity that should drive us on to helping others in society. We'll become too self-focused on ourselves, especially demanding rights in terms of liberty and equality. Now, I'm all for liberty and equality. They are good things in themselves. It is a great idea. And I suppose that the time of the French Revolution, you know, societies were changing dramatically and people were trying to think, well, no, there is a need to emphasise things that we haven't had before. There is great inequality. People are being oppressed. So these things are good in themselves. But they happened at a time when the world was very different from it is today. We had, so to speak, some sort of boundary which constrained society, constrained how free and how equal you actually could be. So things like the economic pressures, we didn't have the freedom to just get up and sort of think, oh, well, I'll take 6 months off work, or I'll go away and take a year out, or I'll just swan about and not study or not work, you know, because you had to do those things. You had to get on with your life and support yourself. That has changed a lot. We had strong traditions within our communities. We had families were united. You tended to live near to your family, to your parents, to your brothers and sisters. So you had a strong sense of identity in your community. And those communities tended to be marked with a strong religious faith. They were times of faith when people did respect religious leaders, when they did look to the religious community for providing guidance. But those things have changed. Those, what I would say, were restraining forces on the misuse of freedom and equality, or the misunderstanding of them, have changed dramatically. We've had a massive growth in prosperity. In fact, there's a book out, I can't remember the actual title of it, but the author's thesis really is, how do we deal with affluenza? How does the modern world deal with being so affluent? You know, we have hyper wealth. We can do whatever we want now. Again, at lunch we were talking about, just when you watch people come out of a supermarket, the amount of food they buy. You know, that nothing for even for normal average families, there seems to be no limit. And if they want something really, they could go out and they can buy it. At the same time as that, we have massive change in mobility. Communities aren't tightly bound together now. We don't just live in the same village where we work and where we grew up with our friends from school or brothers and sisters. We can move all over the country quite easily, all over the world, in fact. And so it is easy. I could go down to London and get a job there and find a flat, and no one would ever know me. No one would talk to me in the subway. No one would even care how I do. I look now, and even in Glasgow, at what people wear. I don't know if you see these people. I see them. You know, their trousers are down there at the backside, and their backside is hanging out them. No one actually laughs at them. No one. When I was at school, but you have this nightmare. You turn up at school, you're not wearing your trousers. You have that nightmare. But we've actually been able to convince people that you can do that, and it's trendy, and they actually do it, and nobody laughs. It's intrigued me. But nobody actually cares. There's no community value there. When in the past there was a social consequence for being weird or being daft or being silly, folk would have laughed. And they would have had an opinion because it mattered to them. It mattered to their community that folk are walking about with their backside hanging out their trousers. That's saying something. And with that, I've put this picture in here because you're more likely to see a church in this condition now than you are to see them building new churches. I'm afraid we have had a massive decline in religiosity. And we have now seen even people, I'm afraid, who notionally are Christian are unlikely to be going to church. A recent publication from the Scottish government looked at religiosity of young people between 11 and 25. Something like 7% of them would go to church. 7%. It's not a lot. So we've had a massive change. Robert Bork, the guy I cited earlier, he talks about some of the why his society, as well as his thesis about liberty and equality, have lost the restraining boundary. They've lost that boundary they had when they were first promoted. He talks about we have a boredom now. People don't know the meaning of life, you know. So they're sort of pretty bored, and it's as if they can be in an adolescence. You know, some sociologists are saying this now. People aren't starting to grow up until their mid-30s because they can live and go out to the pub and the dancing until their mid-30s. They don't think about getting married anymore. They can get in and out of sexual relationships. It doesn't really matter, and no one's going to shun them, no one's going to laugh at them or speak badly of them. There's no real social consequences for them. There's no demands on them to force them to grow up. And also, he cites that we can often have, he identifies it, this sort of self-loathing, that somehow we can hate ourselves in the West, when even the values of the West, which were really built on Christianity, have made prosperity possible, have made the standard of living we have possible. And yet somehow there's a self-loathing of it. We've forgotten what is it that made our society possible. So I'd say a new understanding of society, of liberty and equality, when we put it in a secular framework as something more like this, we have a radicalised version of liberty. Liberty is do whatever you please. It's not a freedom to do what is right, but it's a freedom to do what you please. And anyone who tries to offer you rules or a constraint, is seen as an impediment to your freedom and your enjoyment. Which leads, obviously, to a great individualism. You know, it's my way. What would I want out of this? What's best for me? And we've seen the consumerism. As we see life really, with no holds barred, with no sense of community to sort of supervene on what I choose for myself, it's easy to see life about just satisfying my appetites. So it's no surprise that, you know, if you've got very strong appetites, which are good in themselves, they do produce, they do perform a function. You know, we need hunger to make sure that we eat. You know, but when hunger is just satisfied for its own sake, for the pleasure of satisfying that, you know, is it surprising that we see so many obese people in society, or that things get out of alignment in people's minds about the role of food in their lives? You know, it's just something that's silly. Yet we see people with bulimia or people who are obese and stuff like that. But, you know, the sexual appetite is vitally important. God has built it in that he wants us to reproduce, so there is a strong appetite there. But when we detach the appetite from what it exists for procreation and for survival of humanity. But if it's just as a pleasure on its own that we satisfy and we enjoy satisfying it, then what we do is we nurture or we lose a self-control. And what we do is we nurture vices rather than nurture virtues. I put in the equality of outcome as well. That's an interesting avenue as well. I think I might have included the note in my next slide. Yeah, I think I have. Yeah. Equality of outcome. Sorry it's so small, but it's for me to read out. The thing about equality of outcome, it used to be very much that we all believe in equality, but it was equality of opportunity. There is a sense of justice in that. Give people a chance to see what they can do with it. But very much that is moving. If you read some government papers now about equality, they talk about equality of outcome. Now, there are there's a lot of sort of ideas behind that itself. But anyway, equality of outcome, ironically, is in tension with freedom. Because we know in the world you can't get equality of outcome if people have a diversity of talents and opportunities. So we can try and sort out those opportunities, that's fair enough. But if we try and make sure that everyone gets the same outcome, no matter what choices they make, then that becomes much more difficult. It means that you have to enforce things like political party shortlists for candidates, for example. You know, the people say, even if there's only 5 women going forward and 100 men, well, we want equality on the shortlist. We have to determine what that is itself. If we want to set up a Christian union or group within a university, you know, well, they will say, well, why are there not Muslims in it? You know, that's the sort of daft things you're getting there. Why are there not atheists in your Christian society at university? You know, there should be an equality of outcome. We want people participating, you know, across the band. Whatever choices they've made, they should still have the same right. And we've seen it in families as well. If I choose to be homosexual, well, you still deserve to have children. Surely those people who are marrying a man and a woman, they've got children. Why on earth shouldn't you have children just because you happen to want to have a relationship with someone of the same sex? So there's real bizarre philosophies that at play, which lead us into absurdity, I think, if you don't sit back and ponder them and think, well, no, those things can't be right. Sorry, I just put those things in. The philosophy behind, again, a lot of this depends on who you read, their different views, but I think they're all getting to the same thing. You know, we are now facing moral relativism, indifferentism, utilitarianism, just using people for what we can get out of it, what benefits us, but hedonism, this radical liberalism and radical equality. And, you know, we've reduced the human person to sometimes a machine. We're losing an idea of the spiritual dimension of the human person. It's the very thing that makes them great. Now, I know there's other iron laws if you do other subject areas, but I sort of made this one up myself, the iron law, that if you can affect attitudes, if you can change people's attitudes so radically, you inevitably change their behaviour. We do tend to, if we change our attitudes, we will, of course, be influencing the way we behave. We will make our choices based on those new attitudes. So if we dramatically alter people's attitudes, we will change their behaviour and we will radically change the consequences for society. And I think that's what we need to put across. That's why we're seeing a transformation. If we've changed those ideas about freedom, about equality, about even what the human person is, is a human person something that's is life a gift that's been given and to be accepted, male or female, or is it something that we can mess about with as we please? Can we reconfigure the family just the way we would like it to be or not? Well, those things will affect our behaviour and they will affect the consequences that we have, and I think that's what we're living through just now. Now, what we are informed, we, the church at least, when it looks at these issues, looks at how ideas impact in society, we have perhaps a view of human nature which I'm afraid others in society don't have. At least we have an objective, transcendent set of values that we can turn to give us an insight into the things that matter, to right and wrong, to what is good and what is bad. And I don't know enough about Reformed theology, if that's the right word. I mean, is that Catholic, traditional Catholic would say that because of original sin, our intellect is darkened, our will is weakened, and we have concupiscence, that we are inclined to do things that are wrong? Is that standard? Sorry, it's
Calvin.
Is that Calvin? Pope Calvin. Well, that's our understanding of that we do recognise that human beings which aren't completely rational, that, you know, we can make mistakes in our intellect, our will. I'm a bit worried to venture into this area in a theological environment, but the Catholic understanding of the fall would have been that it would have been a state of original justice and integrity, where our will was informed by our intellect, and we would have followed our intellect, whereas original sin subverted that, and instead of our intellect being able to see the good and choose the good, our will's fighting, going, well, that sounds good. You know, a bit like, I know a cream bun is bad for me. You know, so intellectually you can say, well, I think I'll skip that cream bun, but my will's saying, John, eat it, it's lovely. You know, you've got that aspect of you, and there is that fight within each soul that you can know, and that's a part of, I don't know if Adam and Eve ate cream cakes, but that's our understanding of how our inner self is perturbed. There is a battle going on within us on issues. Now, I've mentioned this about human appetite. If human appetites, again, this idea of virtues, a Christian view of virtues are practicing habits, practicing being good, forms you into a virtuous person. Whereas choosing to do bad can incline you to make it easier to be bad in future, to choose to do wrong in future. So those things have an imprint. When we choose to do something, if I choose to sin, I make myself a sinner, and I'm more inclined to sin in that way in future. In that environment, if we live in a society which does go wrong, does start to promote ideas that are wrong, then our consciences can be numbed with that. If we are satisfying vices, if we're enculturating vices within us as a person, well, I start to deaden my conscience as I start to do things that are wrong, and we lose sight of the truth. And society, Christopher Dawson's a sort of a social historian, so I don't know if you've come across him, he's a Catholic social historian, but anyway, he looked at the development of cultures, and he said that the prerequisite of culture is self-restraint. If I can't restrain myself and work for the benefit of other people, then I'm afraid it's not very good for society. And what we've seen then in the last, it's been going on, as I say, I went back to the idea of the Enlightenment, the French Revolution ideas were sort of crystallised then. But if in the last 9 years of the Scottish Parliament, I've had a chance to look at this and seen that we have had a massive change. Can you remember the news coverage when they proposed Clause 28? Can you remember that? Now, Clause 28 was chicken feed compared to what they're doing now. Who would have thought that they would have homosexuals able to marry, to go into churches and have religious ceremonies now? That Christian groups are going along and doing those sort of things. Who could have thought about the changes in sexuality, that we could say, well, there's a man there, but he's decided he's a woman? And who could have believed that it would have changed in that time? Who could have believed that children would be getting positive homosexual role models to teach them about the goodness of homosexuality? There's been these things are happening. Who could have thought that family relationships have been altered so much that a same-sex couple can go up, and I could suffer the penalties of law for differentiating between a same-sex couple and a married couple? Who would have thought that, even that short space of time? So it's because of that I'm afraid we have. How do we take all that? How do we take all those ideas, that diagnosis of trying to understand what's happening, and then apply it to all these issues that I pointed out earlier? Are we any further forward? Well, I think in diagnosing this idea that we have misused our freedom, I think what really we're getting to is the fact that these are symptoms of a degraded culture. It's a culture really that's lost its way. And how do we put that right? And very often people don't know they're doing the wrong thing. I meet a lot of these campaigners, and even people working for homosexual rights, and that they are sincere people often, and they perhaps have encountered some injustice in their life. I very often find that there's a group in England called Encourage, which is a support group for homosexuals, and I, when the Clause 28 came out, I made touch with them and went down to visit them in London, and they have often come across hardship, and they have often come across injustice, you know, and maybe this is the penalty. Maybe that when the Christians don't support people who have difficulties in life, maybe we have to face it the hard way. But anyway, we have a degraded culture, and really I think the turning point, the way to turn it round, is to try and look at awakening, at least starting to awaken people's consciences. And that's why the furore with Cardinal O'Brien over the last couple of weeks, so we see this as maybe a starting point. Can we get people to think that, no, your conscience at least is sacrosanct. There's something special about your conscience, that at least follow your conscience. That's a starting point at least. And so this is a John Paul II, 1981, say that the man whose heart is hardened and whose conscience is degenerate, even if he is in full possession of his strength and physical capacities, is sick spiritually, and everything must be done to restore him to health of soul. So people who are doing the wrong thing, and they don't know they're doing the wrong thing, they are ill. There is a need to help them, and spiritually we as a Christian community have to try and reach out and help turn that around for them, help identify them, for them, the objects of good and evil, of light and darkness. Now I've taken this is, I'm sure for all of us, it's one of our favourite parts of scripture, John 3:16, but just after this, God so loved the world and gave his only begotten son for us. This is crucial for us. This is at the heart of what we believe and what we can offer to the world. Even Jesus, I was hearing someone reflect on this recently, and just saying, like, no one was more eloquent. I'm not more eloquent than our Lord was. No one knew or understood human nature or how to give a message to anyone better than our Lord, and yet he was rejected. And we see here that even when the light came into the world, people preferred darkness to light. I don't know, I don't understand why fully, but sometimes that's what we're up against. Some people just want to do things that are wrong. Although it goes on there and says that it's because the light exposes their actions. They don't want to be told what they're doing is wrong. Again, that's a turning away from God and a turning to ourselves. What suits me? And very often we can get enclosed in that. But even though that's, I'm going to go on a wee bit and look at a meditation that Pope Benedict XVI made on this before he was Pope, actually, trying to tease that idea of conscience out. What do we do in a society that seems to have gone wrong? Where do we attribute blame? Do we attribute blame at all, in fact? But nonetheless, even if we're not trying to judge and tell people they are bad people, we still have to objectively tell them what's right and wrong, and point, be at least a light on the path of life for them if we want to turn and transform society around. Now, in the issue I wanted to raise, just because I found it, I'm sure it was in the, I'm sure it was values in a time of upheaval, as Cardinal Ratzinger, that Pope Benedict XVI meditated on this. And he was saying that he was at a conference and they were chatting about conscience, and someone raised the issue of, what about the Nazis who thought that killing Jews was a good thing? What about them? Are they judged? Are they saved? And he said that, as he listened to the discussion, someone said, no, if they really thought it was the right thing for them to do, no, they're saved. They did the right thing, so they are saved. And he was astounded by this. He said, oh, at the time he was taken aback and didn't have the right words to formulate a response, but he thought, no, there is something wrong in that. Something definitely wrong. And the view that was put forward was saying, like, if their conscience doesn't accuse them, if those people's consciences is not accusing them, then surely they must be saved. And so that got him to ponder that idea, and he presented it in several different places, but in that particular book, Values in a Time of Upheaval. And he found that the work of a sociologist called Albert Gores made this statement. I'll read that out for you. It's a bit smallish as well. But monsters, among other brutes, are the ones without guilt feelings. Perhaps Hitler did not have any, or Himmler, or Stalin. Maybe mafia bosses do not have any guilt feelings either, or maybe their remains are just well hidden in the cellar. Even aborted guilt feelings. All men need guilt feelings. That's Albert Gores, as quoted by Cardinal Ratzinger. So there is something about this idea, what I'm saying about earlier on about conscience. If the person's conscience is degenerate, they're in poor health. Just as my body needs to be healthy, know that that's sore. Physically, for the sake of my health, spiritually, without feelings of guilt, I am guideless. I have no way of determining what is the right thing to do. And Cardinal Ratzinger went on and looked at, from Scripture we can find these things, that just because I don't feel guilty about it, you know, I can still be wrong. And he then goes on, he uses this to determine that two levels, I'll go into a slide in a second, two levels of conscience that we have to be alert to as Christians, that how we can help to guide people in the path of choosing right and wrong in society. But anyway, then Psalm 19 has this, but who can discern his errors? And it asks the psalmist, and we have someone with a PhD on the Psalms here who can make sure my interpretation's right, or the Cardinal Ratzinger's was, forgive my hidden faults, the psalmist pleads. Forgive my hidden faults. So even faults that I don't know I have, I'm capable of sinning, even though my conscience does not rebuke me. And if you can read that, I tried to read that in the train coming over in the print there, and I've got sore eyes since trying it, so please don't try it. The part really, I just cut and pasted that quickly, but the part here really that I want to refer to is down here, Romans 2, around about 16, and it's when St. Paul is talking about those who live apart from the law. They will still be judged, there still will be a judgment on them, but right and wrong. He's getting to the idea that within them is a sense of right and wrong. Within us there is God's voice somehow, if we could only listen to it. And again, I'm drawing in, finishing off Cardinal Ratzinger's point about, from this, from his meditation on that, he looks at two levels of conscience. The Scholastics really looked at conscience as being an application of reason, deducing, like, I've been told, I know this is wrong, what are the situations, what are the goods, what are the objects, what are the circumstances, and I can deduce from that the way to act. Now, usually that would rely on an awareness of some sort of external law, some light from without that can point the way to me about this is right and this is wrong. And meditating on that and applying it, I can discern the way ahead. So that's me looking at the bottom one, second one. The other, so that's a sort of scholastic view, a Thomas Aquinas perspective of conscience. But there is another, and Augustine looked at, you know, in our soul has been stamped for good. There is within us an idea of what is right and wrong. There is a voice where God speaks to us within ourselves that we have to listen to. And we live in such a noisy, frenetic society. Do we get a chance to do this? Very often I've said I've met sincere people who are doing very bad things. You know, do they often get the chance within themselves, really, in the quiet of their heart, to ponder their conscience and what is right and wrong and listen for God's subtle voice there? I think in our society that's harder than ever. This is just a long quote. It was really for my own benefit as I was thinking through this. But Cardinal Ratzinger referred to this, what was found after the collapse of communism, we're living under that atheistic regime, quite a brutal dictatorship, and that there was enormous sort of deformation of people's consciences. You know, that society round about us, as our society goes bad, it can't but help having an impact on individuals. I'm afraid Christians, this can happen to us all as well. We tend to be products of the environment in which we live. The way society does things, the way institutions in society do things, very often Christian institutions will just do things the same way as society. The values and arguments that are put forward by the world, I'm afraid they work their way into the Christian community as well, and into each one of us. So we constantly have to refine it. And a focus towards the end of his life of John Paul II, and has been picked up by Benedict XVI, is to look at the two wings that are needed to sustain society, that is faith and reason. And they argue that both of them are needed to refine each other. Because reason on its own can give you the gulag, can give you the concentration camps. It has to be refined by faith. But likewise, faith on its own without reason can lead to religious conflict and suppression. And you know, we've seen the witch hunts and the religious wars across Europe. We do need reason. They need to work hand in hand with each other. So I'll pass on that comment just now. But conscious reduction to the subjective certitude betokens at the same time a retreat from the truth. So this is the idea that if we forget about this, if we don't ponder the truth within us, that the voice of God within us, then what we have to do is look at the subjective measures that are in our society. Not an objective truth that's out there, but a subjective truth that just are the values in which we've grown up, the values of the institutions around us. And so that he's getting at the notion of that we really are blind in that. How can I judge another society? How can I look back at in the Nazi regime if everyone at the time thought it was a good idea? Dietrich von Hildebrand, there's a book, a biography of his life. It looks, and he was perplexed. He was a philosopher living in Germany of the early 20s, and he was perplexed that churchmen and social leaders were all starting to go along with National Socialism. They all thought it was great to get Germany back on its feet again, to be proud of the nation. And he was taken aback that this was now a new basis or font of truth, rather than an objective truth. It was a very interesting book, his experience of that, how people within society can be manipulated by the institutions around them. But truth, we live in a society now that sees truth as a burden, the yoke of the truth. You may have come across this yourself. I've come across it myself where people say, oh, John, it's hard for us. We know, we're Christians, we know the truth, and it's a burden on us now. We've got all these extra rules and all the rest of it. Oh, it's going to be really hard for us to get to heaven, whereas folk who are not Christians, they don't know any better, they can just do what they please. And again, Cardinal Ratzinger, that same article that influenced me a lot, he's saying, really, surely the good news cannot be a burden. The good news cannot make it harder to get to heaven, cannot make it harder for us to follow God's will. Surely not. Surely the good news is a gift that makes life so much easier, that helps life turn out better. And again, this is a point I think we've got to make. It's that understanding of the truth as a yoke or as a burden is surely a misunderstanding of it. It's surely a lack of appreciation of what the truth is. A sure guide, or an access, or an insight into God's ways, and not just to be trapped in our own ways of our society or us, our individual whims. And I think, sorry, I should have put in there Matthew 11:30. I'm sure you can quote that better than me, so maybe not try. But you know, my yoke is light, my burden is light, and my yoke is easy. Thanks. So it's truth, then. That is the difference. That is what the Christian community has. We have this revealed truth, but often accessible to human reason. The truth is what differentiates us and makes the formation of conscience, which can turn around society. The truth is the difference from a secular society which puts the focus on the individual and the subjective. It's getting that truth out there to people. And probably the most well-known within Catholic communities, or the most influential social teaching document, was Centesimus Annus by John Paul II. And in that, you get into a lot of trouble with some parts of this. But if we do part from the truth, we're leaving ourselves open to any cultural wind that can sweep us this way or that way. And this last point, I think, is a crucial one for our society, that truth is a good thing. It protects us all, because without it, it must be observed in this regard that if there is no ultimate truth to guide and direct political activity, then ideas and convictions can easily be manipulated for reasons of power. It's no surprise, really, in society, in politics, it's no surprise that the powerful and the mighty, those who have the greatest influence, those who have access to the media, it's no surprise that they get their way, is it? It's no surprise, really, if there is not a truth to restrain them. If there's no truth that I can point and say, no, that's wrong just because it is wrong. Not because I'm the loudest voice and I have the most influence. It's simply wrong. Without that, I'm afraid we're all at the mercy of the powerful. And what is the church then? What's the church role in this? And it is really that. We are a light to the world. We are a witness to Christian memory. Because it's Christian memory, it's the deposit of faith that has been given us by Christ that we have to remember. That's a transcendent set of values that we have to point to. That's the external law. Even when society's values and pressures make it difficult for us to discern the law within us, there is a witness to Christian memory outside that can help us to refine and help us to pay attention to the voice of God within us as well. And really, that Christian memory, the social teaching of Christianity, is really an application of that to the issues that are facing us. All those issues I had up in that chart, the pictures, all of those really social teaching of Christians is applying what we know about the truth of Christ's message and the truth of the human person, and weighing those up in the issues that confront us. And there will always be very strong temptations to go the way of the world, but you know, with truth and with reason, hopefully we can discern the proper path to choose. So that's just that. I'll give you that in the handout, you know, but just there, I just picked out some points, some pillars of social teaching that we know, things that about the dignity of the human person. We are made in the image of God, about the right to life, about the ability to serve God, and the proper role of the state. What is the role of the state? What's the role of autonomy of the individual and the different roles of society. And some of the, I mean, these are all developed quite a lot, and sort of within the Catholic Church at least, we have a separate sort of corpus of work, the social teaching built on a famous document called Rerum Novarum in 1891. But since then, sort of social teaching has become a sort of an area of expertise in its own right. Now, to do that, now this is the thing, so we can help diagnose it. All right, the world's in a mess, we've got the answer, but how do we do that? How on earth do we get, sort of, if we have access to the truth? Well, I think it's, you know, Christ has given us, the message is simple. It's not that hard. You know, it's go out into the world and be the leaven. The trouble is we're finding it harder and harder now. Those young people, 7% of them want to go to church, 7% of them are hearing what the Christian message is. How do we get them to be the leaven in such a lump of dough? It is very difficult. And so I think we need to have the confidence that we actually have something that is not a burden and is not a yoke for society. A confidence that Christianity has a truth that is actually not us imposing ourselves, imposing our views on the rest of society, but it's taking a gift. It's a gift that we are Christians, and we have to share that gift, and we will be responsible for the talent we have of having that gift of the Christian faith. And with that evangelisation, that confidence to evangelise again, we can help awaken consciences. And I think that will happen in a one-by-one basis. It's just meeting the people in your lives. But part of it will be this. I suppose this is the shortest point I'm making, but it's probably the most vital. If we need to go out and educate and forum people, we need to form a new generation of apostles and disciples who can go out into society, not just educating, but forming them, getting their will so that they can withstand the pressures of the modern world. And there's a vital need now to prepare people who can go into politics, into civil society, who have a proper Christian worldview that they can adhere to, and so that when they become politicians, they don't just bow to the party whip, they don't just bow to the loudest voice of pressure groups, but they do what is right. And that is a difficult job. It's difficult in politics to follow a Christian faith. You need to be formed in, well, where are the areas that I can compromise, or where are the areas that I must, if it comes to it, lose my job? Those are the sorts of questions that have to be addressed and have to be nurtured in the politicians of the future. And so this is the environment in which they have to do it. We need to, this group at the bottom, I think it was someone from CARE, set up World Youth Alliance. The World Youth Alliance is looking at that, training up young people, and that's what we need to do. I can write to, here's your local guys from this area, Mike Pringle, Nigel Griffiths. I can write to them, my hand's blown away, but I can't rely on them. I can't rely on them just changing overnight. They've had a lifetime of formation and a totally different set of values for all I don't know if those guys are Christians or not. I don't know enough about either of them, but I suspect they have very different views in some areas than we might hope that they would have. So why, of a lifetime of them reinforcing those ideas, are they going to change because they get a postcard on the human fertilisation and embryology bill? It's going to take a lot for them to change. And so really there is a lot of work needing done at the grassroots of preparing the next generation of politicians. And really I think, just to return back to what the overall message I would say is that there was a good article in one of the, it was an Asian Weekly last week, but it was because Pope Benedict had baptised a Muslim guy, he'd come into church, but someone had wrote an article saying Pope Benedict has a mustard seed and he's not afraid to use it. And I just thought that was exactly, that we have the faith and we have to say, like, if we can deposit that faith into the world, it can transform it. So I'll finish with those words. It's through the full proclamation of Christ and his gospel, a gentle but invincible force is unleashed in the world. Okay, thanks for that.
Thank you, John, for that very full presentation and